From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We will empower Nigerian women in all areas of our national life. We will support and increase the rate of laws that restore their dignity and deal drastically with crime.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is sworn in as Liberia's new president, making her Africa's first elected female leader. In Latin America, Michelle Bachelet has become Chile's first female president.
My government will be a government of unity. I will be the president of all Chileans.
Bachelet is a former political prisoner who, along with her mother and father, a Chilean general, were tortured under the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. We'll speak with a Chilean torture survivor, a Chilean-American writer, Earl Dorfman, as well as the widow of a U.S. journalist killed by the Pinochet forces. And two civil rights groups are filing separate lawsuits today, challenging President Bush's order for the National Security Agency to conduct domestic spy operations without legally required court warrants. We'll speak with the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Okay, well, this program is unquestionably illegal. Congress has made all electronic surveillance outside of the Wiretap Act and FISA a felony. So the big mystery is really not whether it's legal, but why they did it. And perhaps the only explanation that makes sense is that this administration wants to establish that it's not bound by law at all. It wants to, as Cheney said earlier this month, reverse the erosion of presidential power that occurred during the Watergate era.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Chile, former political prisoner Michelle Bachelet has become the country's first ever female president. Running on the socialist ticket, Bachelet beat her billionaire rival in Sunday's election. Bachelet is the daughter of an Air Force general who was tortured and died in prison after Augusto Pinochet seized power in 1973. She, too, was imprisoned before fleeing into exile. Meanwhile, in Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has been sworn in as president, making her Africa's first elected female leader. We'll have more on both Chile and Liberia later in the program. Here in this country, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union are filing separate lawsuits today challenging President Bush's order for the National Security Agency to conduct domestic spy operations without legally required court warrants. The New York Times reveals today after the September 11th attacks, the NSA began sending a flood of telephone numbers, email addresses, and names to the FBI in search of possible terrorists. This forced the FBI to send out hundreds of agents to check out thousands of tips every month. According to the Times, virtually all the leads tips led to dead ends or innocent Americans. Meanwhile, on Monday, former Vice President Al Gore gave a major speech in Washington accusing Bush of repeatedly and persistently breaking the law by authorizing the NSA wiretaps. Gore called for Attorney General Berto Gonzalez to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the abuses. Gore said Bush's illegal spying program threatened, quote, the very structure of our government. Now, Republican Senator Arlen Specter, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has admitted impeachment is a possibility if Bush broke the law. Specter appeared on ABC's This Week on Sunday.
Impeachment is a remedy. After impeachment, you could have a criminal prosecution. But the principal remedy, George, under our society is to pay a political price.
Senator Specter will have more on the spying program later in Democracy Now! In Pakistan, thousands have rallied across the country to protest a U.S. missile strike that killed at least 17 people, including women and children, in a village near the Afghan border. In Karachi, some 10,000 people protested while chanting death to America and stop bombing innocent people. The U.S. has said little about the bombing, but it's believed to have been carried out by a CIA Predator drone. Intelligence officials said the target of the pre-dawn attack was al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman Zawahiri. Pakistani officials said Zawahiri was not killed, but U.S. officials claim they remain unsure. Pakistan publicly claims it does not allow the U.S. to carry out attacks inside its borders, but this is the third suspected U.S. missile strike in less than 2 months. This is the Pakistani Information Minister, Sheikh Rashid Ahmed.
We deeply regret that civilian lives have been lost in an incident in Bajor Agency. While this act is highly condemnable, we have been for a long time striving to rid all our tribal areas of foreign intruders who have been responsible for all the miseries and violence in the region. This situation has to be brought to an end.
Pakistani Information Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmed. Here in this country, in California, the state has executed its oldest death row prisoner, Clarence Ray Allen, one day after his 76th birthday. Allen's the second oldest person executed in the country since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Last week, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger denied clemency to Allen, even though he was blind, wheelchair-bound, and suffered from severe diabetes and heart disease. The Supreme Court also rejected last-minute appeals. However, in one of the appeals, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer filed a dissent saying the circumstances of Allen's death raises a, quote, significant question as to whether his execution would constitute cruel and unusual punishment. Allen is a Choctaw Indian. He had two Native American spiritual advisors with him last night. The San Jose Mercury News reports he wore a beaded American Indian headband and amulet around his neck and had a white feather on his chest as he was executed. Allen had been in jail for over a quarter of a century for arranging a triple murder. This news from Iran. Britain, France, and Germany have announced they'll ask the International Atomic Energy Agency to hold a special meeting in 2 weeks to consider referring Iran to the Security Council over its nuclear program. Russia and China have agreed Iran should freeze its nuclear program, but Russia's warned against sanctions being placed on Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has lifted a ban on CNN journalists from working in the country. The ban was put in place after CNN misquoted the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, saying Iran has the right to build nuclear weapons when he'd actually said Iran has the right to nuclear energy. In news on Iraq, famed TV newscaster Walter Cronkite has become the latest advocate for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Cronkite made headlines during the Vietnam War when he declared on air the war was unwinnable. At the time, President Lyndon Johnson said, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. When a reporter asked Cronkite over the weekend whether, given the chance, he would offer similar advice on Iraq, Cronkite said, quote, yes, it's my belief we should get out now. Meanwhile, there's been no word about the whereabouts of a pair of Americans kidnapped in Iraq. 28-year-old freelance journalist Jill Carroll was kidnapped 10 days ago in Baghdad. Tom Fox of the Christian Peacemaker Team was seized nearly 2 months ago with three other peace activists from the group, Norman Kember of Britain and Harmeet Singh Sudan and James Loney of Canada. And the U.S. has released 500 people from prisons in Iraq. Among the released were two journalists with the Reuters news agency who'd been held without charge for over 4 months. In other news from the Middle East, Vice President Dick Cheney's in Egypt today visiting with the Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. He'll then head to Saudi Arabia to meet with King Abdullah and then to Kuwait, where he'll pay his respects to the country's emir, Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah, who died over the weekend. On Capitol Hill, the fallout from the massive Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal continues to be felt. Republican Congressmember Bob Ney of Ohio has temporarily stepped down as chair of the House Administration Committee. Ney's identified in Abramoff's recent plea agreement as representative number one. Abramoff reportedly bought off Ney by having his Indian tribal clients give him donations in exchange for political favors. Newsweek's now reporting that federal prosecutors are also investigating whether Ney personally lobbied then-Secretary of State Colin Powell to relax sanctions on Iran. Ney made the request after returning from an expense-paid trip to London paid for by a thrice-convicted felon named Nigel Winfield. Winfield ran an airline spare parts company and was seeking to do business with Iran. Meanwhile, in Texas, public opinion polls show former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay may face a tough time being reelected. Just 22% of respondents in DeLay's home district say they'll vote for him in the upcoming election. In environmental news, British scientists have determined 2005 was the warmest year on record in the Northern Hemisphere and the second warmest year overall since the 1860s, when reliable records began. This comes as the Independent of London has published a dire warning from the well-known scientist James Lovelock, who believes the world has already passed the point of no return for global warming. Lovelock writes, quote, before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable. In India, writer Arundhati Roy has refused to accept a prestigious Indian writing award in protest. Roy accused the Indian government of towing the U.S. line by, quote, violently and ruthlessly pursuing policies of brutalization of industrial workers, increasing militarization and economic neoliberalization. And in Washington, about 800 people gathered Saturday at the National Cathedral for a memorial service for Eugene McCarthy. The former senator and presidential candidate died in December at the age of 89. In 1968, McCarthy challenged President Lyndon Johnson for the Democratic nomination, running on a campaign opposing the Vietnam War. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Chile, socialist presidential candidate Michelle Bachelet was elected the country's first female leader in a runoff election Sunday. She won 53% of the vote, beating out opposition candidate billionaire Sebastián Piñera. She spoke to supporters in Santiago on Sunday after the election results were announced.
My government will be a government of unity. I will be the president of all Chileans.
Michelle Bachelet is a 54-year-old doctor who was imprisoned and tortured in the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Her father was an Air Force general who was arrested and tortured for opposing the 1973 U.S.-backed coup that overthrew the democratically elected President Salvador Allende. Her father died of a heart attack in prison. A medical student at the time, Bachelet was also arrested, along with her mother. They were blindfolded, beaten, denied food for 5 days while their cellmates were raped. They were later forced into 5 years in exile, first in Australia, then into East Germany. Current President Ricardo Lagos, who was constitutionally barred from seeking re-election, made her his health minister 6 years ago, then in 2002 named her defense minister. She'll be the fourth consecutive president from the center-left coalition known as the Concertación that's run Chile since 1990. An agnostic single mother of three, she was not an obvious choice for leadership in Chile, a socially conservative Roman Catholic country. Bachelet told a news conference Monday she'll strive to root out Chile's embedded social divide and pledge to name a cabinet with an equal number of men and women. On foreign affairs, she says she'll try to improve relations with neighboring countries and says she will support the proposed free trade area of the Americas. In her victory speech Sunday, she promised tolerance, saying, quote, because I was the victim of hatred, I've dedicated my life to reverse that hatred and turn it into understanding, tolerance, and why not say it, into love. We spoke with Ariel Dorfman, a Chilean-American professor of literature and Latin American studies at Duke University just before the program. He's the author of numerous books, including Other Septembers, Many Americas, and Exorcising Terror, the incredible unending trial of General Augusto Pinochet. He was on the staff of Chilean President Salvador Allende on the day of the 1973 coup. Dorfman gave us his initial reaction to the election.
Chile has had many victories for democracy in the last, 16, 17, 18 years. And we managed to get rid of Pinochet and elect three democratic presidents. This is the fourth one. When I heard that Michelle Bachelet was the new president of Chile, I felt somehow the same enthusiasm, the same thrill that I felt when we defeated Pinochet in the plebiscite, and the sort of hopes that opened up, the expectations that opened up when we elected the first Democratic president, Patricio Aylwin, in 1990. So it's been an extraordinary experience. It's not only that she's the first woman president of Chile and the first woman who was not, getting into power because she was married to somebody, but on her own merit, but because I think she really embodies a whole new tendency, not only in Chile, but in all of Latin America, which is one for more solidarity, great responsibility, of course, fiscal responsibility at the same time. But the international context in which she is becoming president, and the fact that she has all these factors that should be against her, that, that she's divorced twice, or not divorced, she's separated twice, she's got three children that she brought up by herself. She's a pediatrician. Once again, we have a doctor who is in charge of Chile's destiny, as in the case of Salvador Allende. And again, you have somebody who's worked among the poor, who has seen what they can do, what their needs are, and who, in some sense, changes the whole cultural aspect. And these cultural aspects are very, very important. I don't think, you know, that she's going to be a rabid left-winger, or that she's going to suggest that the Chile is on the road to socialism as it was many, many years ago with Salvador Allende. But I think that it signals a really bellwether change in Chile and in the rest of Latin America. It's part of a whole tendency towards a continent that wants to take its destiny in its own hands. And I'm just thrilled for this. I'm not a very close friend of hers, though I know her quite well. I'm a good friend of her mother's, but she's a decent, hardworking, very charismatic, very down to earth person. You had to ask me one question about what she is. She's down to earth. She's part of the earth in that sense, you know. And Chile continues to startle us and give us new things. Every 6 or 7 years, we do something which seems very surprising to the world. And I'm very glad that we're still able to surprise, because that's part of the great astonishment of, I would say, of the way in which people move forward and try to take over their own fate.
Ariel Dorfman, Chilean American writer, speaking from Duke University, where he teaches. He was an advisor to Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile, who died in the palace in Santiago on September 11th, 1973, when the Pinochet forces rose to power. This is Democracy Now! We're joined in our Firehouse studio by two guests. Emilio Banda is a former student union leader from Chile. In 1986, he was arrested by Pinochet forces and imprisoned for 6 months, where he was tortured. He left Chile in 1993. We're also joined by Joyce Horman. Her late husband was a U.S. journalist in Chile during the 1973 coup. He was detained in Santiago days after Pinochet came to power, and his body was found later, buried in a cement wall. He was 31 years old. For years, Jane Horman has fought to uncover the full story of her husband's death. She sued General Pinochet and other Chilean officials. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger was listed as a witness. Her story was the subject of the Academy Award-winning movie Missing by Costa Gavras. In 99, she obtained classified State Department documents that proved U.S. officials played a role in her husband's death. We will begin with Emilio Banda, your response to the election of Michelle Bachelet.
Well, we're happy, you know, celebrating. It's an historical situation in Chile. We believe many things will continue, like President Lagos' regime or period. And we know that many things, especially the reconciliation process and, some human rights cases will be definitely, you know, get at the final, and we will enjoy that, you know, renaissance of justice and Michelle's role on the government.
You were arrested in 1986.
Myself, as many other union student leader, because the university or college students were really involved in the democratization of the university itself and in the recuperation of the democracy for our country. Actually, the student, the union leader of Chile in 1996, 1997, most of all of them were put on jail for 6 months, 4 months, or some of them for more larger period. And I was one of them, actually.
And how long were you held?
I was like 6 months. But the process and the military tribunals, because the military take the student to the court, keep me, you know, in process for years and years. In 1996, I was stopped in the airport trying to leave Chile because I still having this process from 1986, you know, 10 years after they put me 2 days in jail because I didn't finish that process.
You were tortured in prison?
Not in prison, actually, because the prison was the place where everybody get to rest a little bit after the torture, you know. They took you before the guards of the prison system take you on the prison, and they torture, you know, after you get detained, or in the car, or in a secret place.
But you chose not to leave Chile after you were released.
Right. Actually, it was a compromise of everybody in 1996 because we saw that will be the year of ending of Pinochet. You had to remember Pinochet suffered an attempt of murder in 1987. And since 1985, the people of Chile was absolutely tired of him and using every single way to get rid of him. And the students at that time were really well organized, you know, mobilizing people to the streets, you know, going to taking the campus like a base and don't leave the campus for days and trying to get a national, you know, strike fighting the dictatorship. And after we took the campus for like 6 or 7 days, I remember, on May of 1996, and every single leader of the union was in prison, and I was on the clandestinity, and some people from the Asamblea of the Civil, de la Civilidad, you know, the civil organization that, you know, direct the fight against Pinochet, today the concertation, asked me to go and, you know, present myself on the tribunal. Hmm. I present myself on the tribunal, and they say, we have nothing against you, and then the military take me on the door of the tribunal.
Emilio Banda, we have to break. When we come back, we will also speak with Joyce Horman about the election of Michelle Bachelet, the first woman president of Chile, also a torture survivor. Stay with us.
De nuevo quieren manchar mi tierra con sangre obrera, los que hablan de libertad y tienen las manos negras, los que quieren dividir a la madre de sus hijos y quieren reconstruir la cruz que arrastrará Cristo. Quieren ocultar la infamia que legaron desde siglos, pero el color de asesinos no borrarán de su cara. Ya fueron miles y miles los que entregaron su sangre y en caudales generosos multiplicaron los panes.
Victor Jara singing Vientos del Pueblo, Winds of the People. He also died as the Pinochet forces rose to power, the great Chilean musician near the stadium in Santiago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Michelle Bachelet is the new president of Chile. Our guest, Emilio Banda, student union leader in Chile, 1986, arrested by the Pinochet forces, imprisoned for 6 months. Also, Joyce Horman, her husband, Charles Horman, was a U.S. journalist in Chile, also died right at that time of the Pinochet forces. His body later found buried in a cement wall. And for years, Joyce Horman pursued what happened to her husband, sued General Pinochet, as well as other Chilean officials and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Your thoughts today on the victory of Bachelet?
Well, of course, we were all watching very closely on Sunday. And I have to say, it felt so good to have Michelle Bachelet elected. It felt almost as good as hearing that Pinochet had been arrested in London in 98. It was really an extraordinary release of so much good work. You know, she is such an emblem, really, of resilience and of taking action where when you've suffered that kind of loss that she and her family have suffered, it isn't the first thing that you think about. The pain is the first thing you think about. But the fact that so many people in Chile have been so resilient and to this terrible regime that was Pinochet and to the torture and the terror that existed because of his regime, this resilience is really represented by President Bachelet. And I believe that it's an extraordinary threshold, not only in Chile, but in the world, that such resilience has been elected to the presidency. It's wonderful.
Your lawsuit focused on the connection between the U.S. And its support of the Pinochet forces that were responsible for the torture of the now president of Chile, Bachelet, as well as the death of your husband. Where does that lawsuit stand now?
You know, at first, we had a suit in the United States, and it was a civil suit against Kissinger and other members of the U.S. State Department for information regarding my husband's death. And a lot of the documents were classified. They were redacted. We didn't find out very much information after several years of discovery. When Pinochet was returned to Chile and his immunity, senatorial immunity, was taken away, we filed a suit along with many other Chileans and many other victims of Pinochet's regime against Pinochet and members of his staff and so forth. This one is a criminal case, and it's against him for the death of my husband, the wrongful death of my husband. It is still in court in Chile, as are many other suits regarding the demise of so many people. Hopefully this will be progressing over the next few years, especially with President Bachelet.
And Emilio Banda, your feelings about the president of Chile being a torture survivor like yourself?
Well, that mean things are, you know, getting right in my country. Actually, her experience is pretty, you know, it's great to see on her a person who really take the leadership of being a political prisoner herself and suffering the exile, coming back and take the leadership. She was the defense minister first, you know. And
under Lagos.
Under Lagos. And her dialogue with the army in Chile was the first thing that put an accent on her charisma, actually, because the military traditional, you know, that machismo of the you know, the Chilean society expressed strongly in the military, and putting a woman to talk to them and to, you know, put things clear in the table about human rights and that kind of stuff definitely made her a different person.
She was the first woman defense minister as well in
Absolutely,
Chile.
Yeah. Great, yeah.
Daughter of her father, of course, who was a Chilean general who supported Salvador Allende.
Right, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Emilio Banda, for joining us, arrested in Chile in 1986, a union leader, stayed thereafter. And Joyce Horman, the wife of the widow of Charles Horman, who was killed when Pinochet rose to power, as we speak on this day of after it was announced that Michelle Bachelet had won the Chilean election for president, the first woman elected president of Chile. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we go from Latin America to Africa, where Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has been sworn in as Liberia's new president, making her Africa's first elected female leader. The open-air inauguration was attended by U.S. First Lady Laura Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Liberia is Africa's oldest republic, founded in 1847 by freed slaves from America. Two U.S. Navy warships were stationed off Liberia's coast during the inauguration. At least nine African presidents, including Nigeria's Obasanjo and South Africa's Thabo Mbeki, were among those in attendance. Seated in the front row was George Weah, the soccer star who lost to Johnson Sirleaf and refused to concede the election until last month. Johnson Sirleaf is a 67-year-old Harvard-trained economist who's held positions at Citibank, the United Nations, and the World Bank. She's a veteran politician who was jailed twice and is nicknamed the Iron Lady. In an hour-long speech after the ceremony, she vowed to tackle a national debt of $3.5 billion and to fight rampant corruption. She added she would stand by a foreign donor-backed program that'll oversee state spending. She also vowed to improve gender equality in Liberia.
Endeavor to give Liberian women prominence in all affairs of our country. We will empower Liberian women in all areas of our national life. We will support and increase the rate of laws that restore their dignity and deal drastically with crimes that dehumanize them. We will enforce, without fear or favor, the laws against rape recently passed by the National Transition Administration. We will encourage families to educate all children, particularly the girl child.
Johnson Sirleaf becomes Liberia's first elected head of state since the end of a 14-year civil war. In 2003, the conflict uprooted half the country's 3 million people, left up to 250,000 people dead. Liberia is still reeling from the war. Its road network is in ruins. There's no national telephone network, no national electricity grid, no piped water. For more on Liberia and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, we're joined on the line from Washington, D.C., by Amira Woods, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She is originally from Liberia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Amira Woods.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Amy.
Your response to the inauguration of the first elected woman leader of Africa in your country,
Liberia. I have to tell you, Amy, yesterday was a phenomenal day. As we celebrated Martin Luther King Day, we not only had the inauguration of Africa's first democratically elected woman, but we also had, as your earlier segment indicated, this extraordinary election of Michelle Bachelet in Chile. 6 years into this new millennium, Amy, we are finally entering a new era where women's political leadership and openness in political processes, both on the African continent and in Latin America, are reaching extraordinary levels. And so it was really an exciting moment and a moment we should all be celebrating.
What does the president of Liberia represent?
She represents a complicated mix. You know, she was a political prisoner in prison for 7 months. She was raped in prison and has this history of being an opposition leader. Yet she rose to be senior loan officer at the World Bank, to be a senior officer at Citicorp, to be an administrator at the United Nations. She is she really has a checkered background with a combination of histories. And what we are hoping as progressives is that she will reach within herself for that reform-minded part of her and will uplift progressive values within her administration. We are seeing some interesting signs in the new announcements of her members of cabinet already. Some key human rights advocates from within the Liberian human rights community have already been nominated to posts within the cabinet. So these are steps in the right direction that have to be supported and applauded and really kind of increased.
Can you talk about the program that will oversee state spending? How much control will she actually have?
Well, this is it's a complicated situation, and I have to back up, Amy, to say 3 years ago when we had two crises in front of us at the international community. We had the crisis in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, and we had the crisis in Liberia with Charles Taylor. The international community responded in completely different ways. In the case of Iraq, you had one member of the international community, the United States, going in a mostly unilateralist way and pretty much militarily and economically occupying Iraq to exit out the dictator. In the case of Liberia, the past 3 years have been a complicated mix of the international community working together and working with Liberians. So what you had 3 years ago was a negotiation process led by African leaders from throughout the continent that successfully led to peaceful negotiations and the exit of Charles Taylor. You also had the United Nations sending in peacekeepers, you know, first African Union peacekeepers and then transferring their baton to United Nations peacekeepers to maintain security on the ground. You now have the largest peacekeeping force of the United Nations in Liberia today. What happened as well on the economic end was that the international community has worked to set up an arrangement that I have to tell you I'm a bit skeptical about, right? Where you have the United Nations, but as well the World Bank and other international actors playing a lead role in overseeing the economic governance of the country. So you will have within ministries these international actors actually housed in these ministries. Some in Liberia see it as a way to kind of end corruption. Those of us here in Washington know that corruption is very much alive and well, particularly under this administration in Washington today. So there is no easy panacea. What needs to happen to truly address corruption is not to bring people from Washington to sit in Monrovia, but actually to look at all of the actors, look at the corporations that have been involved in these corrupt practices, look at all of the pieces of the puzzle, and look also to the Liberian people who are so tired both of war and of corruption and are recognizing that this is a day of change.
Amira Woods is with Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. As part of the pledge to fight graft, the new president of Liberia has named the first members of her cabinet, including finance and defense, both of whom have international experience that's likely to find favor with donors. Antoinette Seya, former head of the World Bank program in Benin, was appointed minister of finance, and Brownie Samukai, a former director of police who's received training in the United States and Israel, was named defense minister. Your response, Amira?
Without a doubt, those are checkered backgrounds that are worrisome. It is a mixed blessing. It is interesting that this is going to be the first woman finance minister and probably, very senior post by a woman, and people are commending that. It is worrisome that it is someone who has come out of a very traditional World Bank type experience. The more interesting post is actually the post of labor minister, which is now being held by a Reebok human rights awardee, a former political prisoner himself, Kofi Woods. I mean, there are mixed blessings as you look through that cabinet, some that have very traditional institutional backgrounds and some that have very progressive activist and backgrounds where they have been the voice of the voiceless. So it is a mixed bag. And what we as progressives around the world, but particularly in the Liberian diaspora, have to do is to make sure that those progressive voices are strengthened, are supported, are actually moved from nomination to then actually being firmly in their posts, and that there are additional names from that progressive community that are placed within these senior posts. But we have to recognize also that beyond government, there is an active civil society. That civil society has been awakened over these past 3 years, and they are not going to just sit back and be quiet. They are actively fighting issues like the Firestone Corporation and its exploits of the labor and the environment in Liberia. They are actively pushing forward measures that will look at issues of the World Bank and the economic governance within the country. So the civil society is not going to go away. The level of political discourse, where you had radio stations set up in gas stations to interview people during these elections, that level of political discourse will remain, and you will continue to have an active citizenry vigilant, engaged, and pushing forward an opening in the political process. So I don't think that just stopping at the indications of the names is all that's needed. We have to look at the bigger picture and recognize that there will be a push-pull, and the progressives will continue to push to make sure that the values of protecting the rights of people, the values of protecting the needs of citizens, the values of putting people first will continue to be heard in this new administration.
Amira Woods, the U.S. delegation led by Laura Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, right before she left, Laura Bush said Condoleezza Rice would make a good president of this country. I think Condoleezza Rice got more applause than Laura Bush at the inauguration. Your response?
Well, clearly, as we celebrate women's leadership, what we're really celebrating is an open political space. But what we need is a political space where progressive values, where values that put, you know, the interests of citizens first. Those values have to dominate, values that bring healthy communities. And I have to tell you, I don't think that Condoleezza Rice represents those values. She may be a woman, but a woman within the Bush administration that has not necessarily represented either the interests of women nor the interests of African Americans. So what we need are not just women, but women like Michelle Bachelet that are going to usher in a new agenda, usher in a new day where voiceless peoples have a greater opening and a greater political space.
And finally, we just have 30 seconds, but what will happen to Charles Taylor, who is wanted by a UN tribunal in Sierra Leone for war crimes?
Charles Taylor will be brought to justice. The Liberian human rights community, the Nigerian human rights community, the human rights community around the world will make sure that the rule of law is respected and that those that are guilty of war crimes, again, it's Charles Taylor, but it's also his entire machinery, all his cohorts, not only are brought to justice, but that the wealth that they stole from Liberia is actually tracked and returned to Liberia.
Charles Taylor, the former Liberian president, who, as part of a peace deal in 2003, went into exile in Nigeria. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Amira Woods, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus of Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, thanks very much for joining us. When we come back, we'll look at President Bush's spy program. Stay with us.
El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh, que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad, ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal, el derecho de
The Right to Live in Peace, Victor Hara, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Millions of people around the globe paid tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King this weekend. Here in this country, the national holiday commemorating the civil rights leader was observed yesterday. While Dr. King Day is an official federal holiday, the U.S. government tried to break King many times while he was alive, including arresting him, throwing him in prison, as well as closely monitoring him, surveilling him, opening his mail, tapping his phone. At an address in Washington, D.C. Monday, former Vice President Al Gore recalled the FBI's secret surveillance of Dr. King and called for a special prosecutor to investigate whether President Bush has today broken the law when he ordered the National Security Agency to conduct domestic spy operations without legally required court warrants. This is an excerpt of Al Gore's address.
Republican as well as Democratic members of Congress should support the bipartisan call of the Liberty Coalition for the appointment of this special counsel to pursue the criminal issues raised by the warrantless wiretapping of Americans by the president, and it should be a political issue in any race, regardless of party, section of the country, House of Congress, for anyone who opposes the appointment of a special counsel under these dangerous circumstances when our Constitution is at risk. Secondly, new whistleblower protection should immediately be established for members of the executive branch who report evidence of wrongdoing, especially where it involves abuse of authority in the sensitive areas of national security. Third, both houses of Congress should, of course, hold comprehensive and not just superficial hearings into these serious allegations of criminal behavior on the part of the president, and they should follow the evidence wherever it leads. Fourth, the extensive new powers requested by the executive branch in its proposal to extend and enlarge the Patriot Act should under no circumstances be granted unless and until there are adequate and enforceable safeguards to protect the Constitution and the rights of the American people against the kinds of abuses that have so recently been revealed. Fifth, any telecommunications company that has provided the government with access to private information concerning the communications of Americans without a proper warrant should immediately cease and desist their complicity in this apparently illegal invasion of the privacy of American citizens. Freedom of communication is an essential prerequisite for the restoration of the health of our democracy.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking Monday in Washington. The New York Times reveals today that after the September 11th attacks, the NSA began sending a flood of telephone numbers, email addresses, and names to the FBI in search of terrorists. This forced the FBI to send out hundreds of agents to check out thousands of tips every month. According to the Times, virtually all the tips led to dead ends or innocent Americans. The NSA had collected most of the intelligence it fed to the FBI by eavesdropping on Americans making international phone calls, as well as by conducting searches of phone and internet traffic. Meanwhile, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union are filing separate lawsuits today challenging President Bush's order for the NSA to conduct domestic spy operations without legally required court warrants. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by Shaina Katidal, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Explain what this lawsuit is about that you're filing today.
Sure. Well, you know, usually when you start a lawsuit, you have more questions about the law than the facts. But here the law is absolutely clear. Congress has made it a felony for government officials to engage in electronic surveillance outside of the two statutes that provide for it, the Wiretap Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So here it's absolutely clear that this program is illegal. And the big questions really for us are, factually, were we targets of this surveillance? And, you know, beyond that, why did they do it? And those are the things that we hope to find out with the lawsuit.
Well, with a lawsuit, it's usually based on something that happened to you. So you don't have evidence that this has happened, that you have been surveilled, monitored, phone tapped, wiretapped.
That's right. Obviously, there's no way to really know with a secret program. We don't have hard documentary evidence that we were surveilled. So the basis of the lawsuit, first of all, is that that we sort of fit the categories that the Attorney General has said are the categories for targets of this program. And I'll just read it. Alberto Gonzalez, in his first press briefing, said that anyone who's a member of al-Qaeda or affiliated with al-Qaeda or a member of an organization that might be supportive of it are targets. And so if you look at the kind of cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights brings. We brought the case on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees, on behalf of Maher Arar, who was, you know, a Canadian citizen on his way home to Canada, stopped at JFK and deported to Syria for torture, and then on behalf of lots of immigration detainees in the sweeps after 9/11 who were suspected of some sort of involvement based on no evidence at all in the terrorist attacks. And so we communicate with those clients or their family members overseas regularly. So we make these international calls and emails as part of our work. And so, you know, to us, we kind of fit, you know, the description of the, you know, those conversations fit the types of conversations that they would have surveilled based on what little they've told us about it. You know, but then beyond that, you know, we feel as attorneys who regularly work with clients internationally that the, you know, the existence of this kind of program inhibits our ability to do our work. You know, at this point, we've got to explain to every potential client who gets in touch with us that you've got to be careful about talking to us. It makes us look suspect. It inhibits our ability to have conversations that, you know, allow us to work on these cases. It just makes it incredibly difficult.
looking at the Justice Department refusal to respond in the New York Times today about you, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the ACLU suing over federal eavesdropping. Justice Department officials refusing to comment on any specific individuals who might have been singled out under the NSA program, and said that the department would review the lawsuits once they were filed. A spokesperson for the Justice Department added that the NSA surveillance activities described by the president were conducted lawfully and provide valuable tools in the war on terrorism to keep America safe and to protect civil liberties.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the ironic thing about it is that the New York Times ran another story today that said that the NSA was dumping huge amounts of really useless data on the FBI and other criminal investigative agencies, and making them trace down, you know, sort of dead ends, you know, giving them bad leads. And at some level, that really exposes what's wrong with these kind of broad brush, surveillance methods. For 200 years, we've had a system where judges have to approve warrants on the basis of probable cause, that, you know, that law enforcement has to go to a judge with a little bit of evidence of criminal wrongdoing for the judge to approve of the wiretap. And you know, the reasons for that are twofold. One, it's to make sure that innocent people don't get surveilled. But the other reason is to make sure that law enforcement doesn't waste its time with irrational profiling or pointless broad searches. It's to make sure that we have efficient law enforcement. And the other New York Times story that ran this morning basically shows that this NSA program resulted in inefficient law enforcement. It made us less safe. You know, people always think there's this trade-off between liberty and security, and that if they're taking away our liberties, it's always going to make us a little bit more safe. And here, you know, it's worked in the opposite way. We've become less free, and we've become less safe.
I wanted to ask you about the specific lawyers that you're suing on behalf of. The ACLU plaintiffs, among them Larry Diamond, who we've had on this program, senior fellow at the Hoover Institute, said that a Stanford student studying in Egypt conducted research for him on political opposition groups, and that he worried communications between them on sensitive political topics could be monitored. He said, how can we communicate effectively if you risk being intercepted by the National Security Agency? Also named as plaintiffs in the ACLU lawsuit, journalist Christopher Hitchens, who's written in support of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Barnett Rubin, scholar at NYU, New York University, who works in international relations, Tara McKelvey, a senior editor at American Prospect, a National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Greenpeace, the environmental group, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the country's largest Islamic advocacy group. What about the specific people in your case and who they represent?
Sure. Well, the ACLU has a nice mix of people from both the political left and the right. Our plaintiffs are all people who work at the center, primarily attorneys, also one paralegal who does a lot of communications internationally. So, for instance, one of the attorneys is the person who works closely with Mara Arar, that Canadian citizen who was deported to Syria by the U.S. from JFK Airport for purposes of being tortured and interrogated under torture. So she's got to, you know, call him and email him routinely. And it's that kind of situation that's really problematic when you've got this sort of surveillance. We really have to think every time a communication is made about whether it makes sense to, you know, put it off for an in-person visit or something like that.
Well, Shaina Caridel, I want to thank you very much for being with us, lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thanks for having us.
As we move now to Haiti, nearly 2 years after the overthrow of the elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haitians have yet to vote for a new government. The U.S.-installed interim regime has delayed elections four times. The latest announced date for elections is February 7th. In a shocking development, Lieutenant General Urano Teixeira de Mata Bacelar, the commander of the UN force in Haiti, was found dead in his Port-au-Prince hotel room last week with a gunshot wound to his head. UN officials called his death a suicide. Bacelar had recently clashed with his superiors and Haitian business leaders over his opposition to their calls for a crackdown on Cité Soleil, the poor neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. Last week, the Brazilian ambassador, Paulo Cordeiro de Andrade Pinto, announced investigators are probing other possibilities before confirming Bacelar's death was a suicide. Chilean General Eduardo Aldunate Herman has been named interim head of the UN force. General Herman was one of 11 former high-ranking Chilean military officials under former dictator Augusto Pinochet, who trained at the U.S.-run School of the Americas. His appointment has stoked fears the UN will step up its raids on poor neighborhoods like Bel Air and Cité Soleil. These raids have already killed scores of innocent people. Many Haitians allege the raids are part of a campaign against President Aristide's Famille Lavalas party. Lavalas demonstrations are routinely targeted. Most of their leaders are in jail or exile. One of them is Father Gerard Jean-Just. He was jailed in July for allegedly for a murder that occurred. It occurred while he was out of Haiti. Government officials subsequently prevented his bid to run for president, claiming he can't run from jail. He remains in prison despite international outcry and the recent diagnosis that he's suffering from leukemia. Meanwhile, another Lavalas leader, the folk singer Soan Auguste, has been in prison since May 2004. Last week, Amnesty International declared her a political prisoner and called for her release. We're going to Haiti right now to speak about the latest with Reed Lindsay. He's an independent international reporter who has written for many publications, including The Observer of London, The Boston Globe, and Newsday. He joins us from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reed.
Thanks a lot.
Can you tell us the latest at this point?
Well, the latest happening here is yesterday there was a sit-in, or so they called it. It was a demonstration organized by the group of 184 in front of the United Nations to protest what they see as a lack of UN action in the face of recent kidnapping, and to call for stronger action in Cité Soleil, to rid Cité Soleil, or as Reginald Bulos, the president of the Chamber of Commerce, said, to cleanse Cité Soleil of criminals there.
And the elections that, four times put off, the latest is they will take place February 7th. Who will run?
Yeah, that date seems pretty certain now. There's not a lot of talk at this point about changing the date again. But the clear-cut favorite is Rene Favall, and there've been some polls, and he's been leading in the polls. But you know, just walking in any poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince and asking people who they're going to vote for, there's some people who are very apathetic and disillusioned with the whole process and aren't going to vote. Don't like anybody, and there are many who will vote for Rene Favall, but it's very difficult to find people who are enthusiastic about any other of the 35 candidates.
And the latest UN admission that in a recent raid of Cité Soleil, that they killed a number of innocent civilians there, something that that we reported on Democracy Now!, that the people of Cité Soleil have been saying for quite a long time, as well as the latest information about the death of Basilar.
Right. I was in Cité Soleil the other day, and the hospital there, the public hospital, which is the only public hospital in Cité Soleil, it's an enormous neighborhood, has received a record number of bullet wound victims the last month and a half, about nearly 100 since the beginning of December, and they keep coming in every day. And you go into the hospital, the wing of the hospital where the bullet wound victims are, and every single one, they say they've been shot by the United Nations.
Reed, are you there?
It's difficult to prove whether it's the UN that's shooting them. But on the other hand, with the amount of shooting that is going on every day, I think that some of these people, you have to believe what they're saying.
Well, Reed Lindsay, we have to end it there. We've come to the end of the program. We'll continue to report on Haiti this week here on Democracy Now! Reed Lindsay speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. You can video and audio podcast our show at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.